Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 1st, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week has in the foreground former Vice President Mike Pence. He's in his suit. He's got his hands sort of spread and raised upward. He's looking upward toward the heavens with maybe you'd call it a pious look on his face. Above his head, there's a halo. In the background, it's the Capitol building. In the mid-ground is a hangman's gallows with a noose hanging from it. The skies are dark and threatening, but above him they are blue with the sun shining through it. The headline is St. Mike. Did Pence's defiance of Trump make him the savior of January 6th? I believe we catch that in our first main story and possibly on a Talking Points article. The main stories and how they were covered. Trump's ruthless pressure campaign. What happened? State election officials this week described how Donald Trump and his allies relentlessly pressured them to help overturn President Biden's election win, and the life-altering threats and harassment they suffered when they refused to break the law. In the fourth hearing held by the panel investigating the January 6th Capitol attack, Rusty Bowers, Republican Speaker of Arizona's House of Representatives, outlined how Trump attorney John Eastman pressed him to replace the state's electors with a pro-Trump slate. When he said that would be illegal, Eastman told him, "Just do it and let the courts sort it out." The cost of refusal was steep, said Bowers, who described Trump supporters repeatedly swarming his house, calling him a pedophile, and upsetting his terminally ill daughter. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who famously resisted the then president's insistence that he find 11,780 non-existent Trump votes, testified about Trump supporters threatening his wife with sexual violence and breaking into the home of his widowed daughter-in-law. An election worker from Georgia, Wandrea Shea Moss, described facing a torrent of racist abuse after Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani claimed she and her mother had taken false ballots from a suitcase and fed them into counting machines. Her mother had to leave her home after the FBI warned her of threats, and a distraught Moss became afraid to tell people her name. "It turned my life upside down," said Moss. "There is nowhere I feel safe." The testimony followed a third hearing focused on Trump's efforts to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to refuse to certify the electoral vote count on January 6th, a plot Trump was repeatedly told was illegal. The panel showed how angry mobs calling for Pence's execution came within 40 feet of him on January 6th. J. Michael Luttig, a retired federal judge highly respected in conservative legal circles, said Trump's bid to overturn the vote brought the nation to the edge of a revolution within a constitutional crisis, and that Trump and his allies are laying the groundwork to try again in 2024. "They are a clear and present danger to American democracy," he said. "I don't speak those words lightly." What the editorial said. The hearings have been predictably partisan and acrimonious, said National Review, but the committee has done important work. The January 6th riot and Trump's Stop the Steal effort were a dismal chapter in our history that must be documented for posterity. The damning evidence of Trump's malfeasance makes clear he shouldn't hold any public office again. Attorney General Merrick Garland must put Trump on trial, said the Boston Globe. As the panel piles up evidence of his criminal wrongdoing, the need to hold him and his cronies and sycophants responsible has never been clearer or more urgent. If they're allowed to get by with nary a scratch after plotting an overthrow of the U.S. government, it will send a dangerous message to future presidents that they can get away with, quite literally, anything. What the columnist said. Moss' searing testimony brought home the human cost of Trump's campaign of deceit, said Sarah Longwell in The Bulwark. It was infuriating to hear her describe her grandmother's terror when Trump acolytes pushed in her door and to see Bowers tearing up when talking about the harassment his family endured because he refused to betray his oath. Republicans who supported Trump's big lie should feel shame. Trump has become an albatross for the GOP, said Rich Lowry in Politico. Republicans are on the cusp of a midterm triumph and primed to capitalize on the Biden administration's stumbles and left-wing overreach. But they're stuck litigating the past because of Trump's depraved conduct and his continuing insistence that Republicans echo his poisonous lie that the election was stolen. The party needs to look to its deep bench of governors and senators for another 2024 presidential candidate and be freed from the need to defend the indefensible. The committee's work has made that more likely, said Juliette Kayyem in The Atlantic. By revealing Trump as a desperate sore loser and showing former aides testifying against him, they've offered an off-ramp for sane Republicans. Trump's critics may yearn for a single blow of reckoning, but perhaps the threat he and his followers pose is best handled with a thousand cuts. As evidence mounts of Trump's criminal wrongdoing, Merrick Garland faces a momentous choice, said former federal prosecutor Jack Goldsmith in the New York Times. Choosing not to prosecute Trump would signal that presidents are literally above the law. But Garland also knows that to indict a former president of the opposite party would be a cataclysmic event from which the nation would not soon recover, one that would threaten to set off tit-for-tat recriminations across political administrations. Whatever Garland decides will have consequences beyond his lifetime. The controversy of the week. Jenny Thomas, a supreme connection to the January 6 plot. Jenny Thomas has a lot of explaining to do, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. We already knew that the conservative activist and wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was an enthusiastic supporter of the plot to overturn the 2020 presidential election. After publication of dozens of text messages in which she urged President Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to bypass the will of the American people and install Trump for a second term. If her contacts with Meadows were shocking, the new information that emerged last week is explosive. Not only did Jenny Thomas email 24 Arizona Republicans urging them to overturn President Biden's victory in the state, but she also contacted conservative attorney and Trump advisor John Eastman, a key architect of the plot to nullify 2020 swing state election results. It's now official, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. We have a coup plotter married to a Supreme Court justice. The hounding of Jenny Thomas is despicable, said David Harsanyi in The Federalist. Democrats have summoned the conservative activist to testify before the January 6 House Committee, but so far these partisan witch hunters haven't been able to present a scintilla of evidence implicating her in a crime. All Thomas did was send private messages expressing her personal opinion, which is her right as a private citizen. Eastman has released a copy of a December 4 email from Jenny, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, and she merely asked that Meadows present a status update on the election battle to a group of grassroots state leaders. Unfortunately, that innocuous request won't deter Democrats, who are absolutely determined to discover a trail of breadcrumbs leading to the Supreme Court. Sorry, but the idea that Clarence Thomas had no idea his wife was in contact with Eastman, Meadow, and Arizona officials beggars belief, said Charles Pearson, Esquire. The justice and his wife have publicly said they are best friends who share everything, including their extreme right-wing worldview. Moreover, Eastman previously served as Justice Thomas' law clerk, so all three would appear to be quite chummy. It is probably no coincidence, Eastman said at the time, that he had heard there was a heated fight underway in the Supreme Court over whether to intervene in the 2020 election. Did he hear about internal Supreme Court struggles from Jenny or his old boss Clarence? This plot grows thicker with every passing day. The Thomas's outrageous behavior should finally end the illusion that the Supreme Court is an apolitical branch of government and a neutral arbiter of the law, said Zhishan Alim in MSNBC.com. Given his wife's active involvement in the election plot, Clarence Thomas should have recused himself from any case involving Trump, January 6, or the validity of election results. He didn't, and in fact was the lone justice to back a request from Trump to block the release of White House documents and communications related to January 6. It's no wonder that polls show that trust in the Supreme Court has tumbled to new lows, dropping 20 points in the last few years, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. As Justice Thomas complained, without evident irony in a recent speech to a conservative group, I wonder how long we're going to have these institutions at the rate we're undermining them. Good week, bad week. It was a good week for working the refs after Miles Copeland, a firefighter who plays for the Toledo Glass City basketball team, performed CPR and saved the life of a referee who suffered a heart attack during a game. When you're off the job, Copeland said, you're really not off the job. It was a good week for ecclesiastical clarifications, with a 30-page ruling from a Church of England tribunal that the Reverend Clive Evans violated acceptable church practice when he stripped to his underwear to perform a full immersion baptism and also pinched two women's bottoms. It was a good week for atmospherics after Ben & Jerry's pledged that its cows will be fed a new diet to reduce the methane, a greenhouse gas, in their flatulence. This is a big deal, the ice cream company said. It was a bad week for political gravity after President Joe Biden's bicycle toppled to the ground when he braked to chat with a gaggle of reporters near his vacation home in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. I'm good, the uninjured 79-year-old president shouted after Secret Service helped him up. It was a bad week for deja vu, with grimly familiar advice from the Centers of Disease Control that people engaging in hookups should avoid kissing and consider virtual sex to avoid contracting monkeypox. Finally, it was a bad week for soccer fans. With a warning from officials in Qatar, the repressive host nation of this year's Soccer World Cup, that foreign fans must refrain from drinking and public displays of affection. It's not part of our culture, said a Qatari official, and that goes across the board to everyone. A short in other news piece while we're here. An unusual January 5th Capitol tour. GOP Representative Barry Loudermilk of Georgia gave a tour of the Capitol complex the day before the January 6 insurrection, during which a man photographed tunnels, staircases, and security checkpoints in house, office buildings that are not normally of interest to tourists. The next day, the man recorded a threatening video near the Capitol ground directed at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Representative Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, saying, "There's no escape. We're coming for you." Another member of Loudermilk's tour group photographed the plaque outside Nadler's office. Loudermilk's tour was captured in video footage released last week by the House January 6 panel. Loudermilk said there was nothing suspicious about the tour. The briefing this week is titled, "Welcome to the Pandemocene. As humans encroach on the natural world, more deadly pandemics are likely to follow COVID. Why? What causes pandemics? Nearly all of them start with animal-to-human transmission of a virus or bacteria to which people have no immunity. Animal pathogens are the source of about 60% of known infectious diseases and 75% of those that appear for the first time in humans. About 250 known diseases have made the leap from animals to humans, but a 2020 United Nations report estimates that as many as 850,000 viruses lurk within the bodies of mammals and birds. Zoonotic diseases have wreaked havoc throughout human history. The bubonic plague, which wiped out up to 60% of the population of Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, and North Africa in the 14th century, was caused by the Y. pestis bacteria transmitted from rodents via fleas. The 1918 flu pandemic, which killed an estimated 50 million people, is believed to have originated in poultry and wild birds. Spillover events appear to be getting more common. HIV and Ebola can be traced back to primates in Africa. The original SARS virus is believed to have jumped from bats to humans by way of a mammal called a civet. COVID is caused by a bat virus, SARS-CoV-2, that recent research has found most likely spilled over from animals sold at a wet market in Wuhan, China in 2019. Although some believe Chinese scientists modified the virus and accidentally let it escape. Why are animal viruses so dangerous? Most viruses that infect animals can't harm us because they lack the ability to bind to human cells. Occasionally, though, one manages to attach and penetrate human cells, replicate, and evolve. This occurs before the immune system recognizes the invader as a threat and makes antibodies and T and B cells to ward off the virus. For animal pathogens to infect humans, direct contact is not necessary. They can also travel through contaminated food, water, surfaces, or via a parasitic vector such as a flea or mosquito. Some animals are more prolific vessels and spreaders of the disease. Over 10% of rodent species host pathogens that can possibly infect people. Apes, monkeys, and other primates, our closest relatives in the wild, carry 77 known zoonotic viruses. And bats, which make up more than a fifth of the 6,400 known species of mammal, are uniquely well-equipped to spread disease, with the ability to fly long distances, and a unique immune system that allows them to carry a high viral load without dying or becoming ill. Why is this threat growing? Humans are pushing further into previously uninhabited areas, triggering a cascade of changes in the natural world. Rapid deforestation in Africa and South America pushes wildlife toward areas where people live and work, increasing the risk of interaction and disease transmission. People in many countries consume the meat and fur of wild animals, the cause of several spillover virus outbreaks, including SARS, monkeypox, and two strains of Ebola. In a recent journal study, researchers at London's Royal Veterinary College hypothesized that rodents in West African cities have enabled the rapid transcontinental spread of monkeypox, which now infects more than 2,100 people in 42 countries, including more than 100 in the U.S. In the jet age, people infected with a novel virus in one country can spread it to the other side of the globe in a matter of hours. And climate change is poised to make the problem exponentially worse over the next 50 years. How does climate change factor in? Scientists warn that we have entered a new epoch, the pandemicine. By 27, there will be an estimated 300,000 first encounters among species that don't normally interact, according to computer models run by Georgetown University researchers. Those encounters will cause about 15,000 spillovers of viruses into hosts with naive immune systems. Some changes are already happening. Mild winters and increased rainfall are a boon for breeding mosquitoes, ticks, and other disease-carrying parasites. Over the past decade, the rate of Lyme disease incidence has doubled, and two new additional tick-borne diseases have been identified. The World Health Organization reports that dengue fever, which causes up to 390 million yearly infections worldwide, has increased 30-fold over the past 50 years. What can be done? Using field work and computer modeling, scientists attempt to spot viral outbreaks among susceptible animals. But it would be nearly impossible to monitor all species all the time. Some countries are also cracking down on the bushmeat trade, but farmed meat also contributes to the spread of disease. The majority of the world's farmland helps feed and house livestock, and creating more farms often requires cutting deeper into forests and jungles. Rather than respond to new pandemics with quarantines and frantic vaccination efforts, it would be far more efficient for humanity to take global preventative measures, such as halting deforestation and new animal farms. But it may be too late to reverse the growing likelihood of viruses jumping from animals to humans. The moment to stop climate change from increasing viral transmission was 15 years ago, said Colin Carlson, the lead author of the Georgetown study. We have to prepare for more pandemics. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. Paul Waldman from the Washington Post writes, "Fomenting Political Violence." One of fascism's key features is the glorification of violence as a domestic political tool, said Paul Waldman. That's worth keeping in mind when watching Republican campaign ads that feature candidates firing and brandishing weapons. The most troubling example of this to date is a new ad from Eric Greitens, a Missouri Republican running for U.S. Senate. The ad shows Greitens armed with a shotgun and a pistol, accompanied by a militia, bursting into a suburban home. "Join the MAGA crew," Greitens says to the camera. "Get a rhino hunting permit. There's no bagging limit. It doesn't expire until we save our country." A rhino, R-I-N-O, of course, is a Republican in name only, a term now used by Trump is to describe any conservative who is insufficiently worshipful of Donald Trump or questions the far right's extremist beliefs. Greitens' invitation to violence comes as Fox News and its ideological brethren issue daily histrionic warnings about the left's genocidal campaign against white people. imminent communist tyranny, and groomers plotting to sexually assault their children. If people believe this propaganda, violence might seem a reasonable response. January 6 was not the last act of political violence our nation will see. Arming teachers is folly. As a gun owner and retired teacher with 34 years in schools, says Paul Carrere, I can tell you with certainty that armed teachers have no place in a classroom. Since 19 school children were murdered in Uvalde, Texas, gun boosters have revived the absurd claim that arming teachers is a solution to school shootings. Just consider the potential for accidents. Every year, trained police officers cause injuries and deaths by unintentionally firing their guns. The same will happen if teachers are armed, and let's remember, they are surrounded by kids. Inevitably, some teachers will leave guns in places where children will find them. Imagine a scenario in which a child brings a fake gun to school, or an unruly student physically attacks an armed teacher. Do we want that teacher to decide in an instant whether to shoot? Imagine police arriving after a school shooting and encountering a man or a woman pointing a gun. Is that the shooter or a teacher? Or imagine teachers engaging in firefights with deranged shooters in crowded classrooms and hallways. The variables are limitless, unforeseen, and all ugly. A sane nation would not try to turn its teachers into cops or soldiers. This column comes from Ukraine. This war is devastating land and sea. The Russians are not content with killing our people, said Igor Barashansky. They are committing ecocide, deliberately laying waste to Ukrainian land and sea to ensure that the country will be polluted for generations to come. The eastern Donbas, where Russia is concentrating its firepower, is our center of industry. There, Russian missiles have blown up hundreds of power plants, chemical and metallurgical factories, and oil depots, lighting fires that can be seen from space and releasing toxic clouds laden with sulfur and lead into the air. The shelling of Azovstal steel and iron works almost led to a catastrophe on a global scale, as it could have caused tons of hydrogen sulfide to pour into the Sea of Azov, rendering it lifeless. That was a near miss, but meanwhile, the shelling of ports along the Black Sea coast has killed countless fish, while the corpses of thousands of dolphins have washed up on our beaches and those of our literal neighbors, Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey. Our irreplaceable wetlands have been contaminated by explosions and the pollution from spent ammunition, devastating water birds such as avocets and pelicans, while our forests are on fire. Even if the fighting ends tomorrow, this war will have caused enormous damage to the ecosystem of the whole of Eastern Europe. The last word, our feature article. After abortion becomes a crime. In Poland, doctors are withholding even life-saving care from pregnant women out of fear of being prosecuted and jailed, said Katrin Binhold and Monica Pronschuk in the New York Times. It was shortly before 11 p.m., when Izabela Szabor realized the doctors were prepared to let her die. Her doctor had already told her that her fetus had several abnormalities and would almost certainly die in the womb. If it made it to term, life expectancy was a year at most. At 22 weeks pregnant, Sabor had been admitted to a hospital after her water broke prematurely. She knew that there was a short window to induce birth or surgically remove the fetus to avert infection and potentially fatal sepsis. But even as she developed a fever, vomited, and convulsed on the floor, it seemed to be the baby's heartbeat that the doctors were most concerned about. "My life is in danger," she wrote in a string of distressed text messages to her mother and husband that was shared with the New York Times by her family's lawyer. "They cannot help as long as the fetus is alive, thanks to the anti-abortion law," she wrote, only hours before she died. "A woman is like an incubator." Abortion has seized the United States' attention anew with the prospect that as early as this month, the Supreme Court could overturn Roe v. Wade, the decision that made the procedure of terminating a pregnancy legal for nearly 50 years. If Roe is overturned, half of American women stand to lose legal access to abortion. Poland offers a glimpse of a country where abortion is already practically out of reach, even in the gravest circumstances. It has long been a showcase of the volatility and vicissitudes of the abortion battles, and how the lives of women and their doctors are tossed about on shifting social and political tides. The long battle over Poland's 29-year ban on abortion has intensified over the past 17 months after the elimination of the last significant exception permitting the procedure, fetal abnormalities. Since the exception's elimination, deaths like Sabor's have been rare, one of three cited by abortion rights advocates. But they have become a touchstone of grievance for those who say they demonstrate the risks to women posed by restrictive abortion laws. Only 1 in 10 polls support the stricter ban, which was enabled by a decision by the country's highest court, dominated by judges loyal to a deeply conservative government. The rest of the population is roughly split between reverting to milder restrictions and legalizing terminations. Today, Poland and Malta, both staunchly Catholic, are the only European Union countries where abortions are effectively outlawed. The consequences in Poland have been far-reaching. Abortion rights activists have been threatened with prison for handing out abortion pills. The number of Polish women traveling abroad to get abortions, already in the thousands, has swelled further. A black market of abortion pills, some fake and many overpriced, is thriving. Technically, the law still allows abortions if there is a serious risk to the woman's health and life. But critics say it fails to provide necessary clarity, paralyzing doctors. This law creates problems for doctors and patients. Jan Kokanowicz, a doctor who is also director of the University Clinical Hospital in Białystok, the largest city in northeastern Poland, said in an interview, "There is no clear and straightforward answer to what constitutes a threat to a woman's health and life. Doctors are afraid to make decisions." Defenders of the Polish abortion ban say these are extreme cases caused not by the law but by doctors' poor judgment. The law should not have a chilling effect because legislation on abortion when a woman's health or life is in danger has not changed, said Katarzyna Gasiuk, head of the Center for Medical Law and Bioethics at Ordu Uris, a Catholic organization that lobbied for the new ban. She agreed with opponents of the law that, in its current form, the measure was too general and too open to interpretation. But her concern was that it gave doctors too much latitude to perform abortions. For abortion rights supporters, clarity is less the issue than what they say has been a steady erosion of women's autonomy since the abortion ban nearly 3 decades ago. Just this month, the government required Poland's central health care system to log pregnancies. Opponents called it a pregnancy register that could be used to track down illegal terminations. Once you start chipping away at the right to abortion, It's hard to go back, said Christina Capura, president of the Federation for Women and Family Planning, or FEDERA, a Warsaw-based advocacy group. We are now at a point where the risk to women's physical and mental health have reached a new quality. Poland was once a destination for women seeking abortion. Under communism, the Catholic Church was marginalized and abortion was legalized in 1956. Women were encouraged to work and granted sweeping reproductive rights that Western democracies embraced only decades later. With abortions in Poland cheap and available practically on demand, women from all over Western Europe flocked there until well into the 1980s. But that changed after the communist government collapsed in 1989. Bowing to pressure from a newly assertive Catholic Church, which had supported the fight against communism, the new parliament proposed an abortion ban. No one knew at the time that the period of democratization would mean such a backlash for women's rights, said Magdalena Sroda, a professor of ethics at the University of Warsaw. It was a return to the discourse of traditional women's roles as wives and mothers. It would become one of the defining culture wars of the new democracy for decades to come. Women's groups organized protests and signed petitions. Three in four Poles told pollsters at the time they preferred the issue to be settled by a referendum, not by parliament. The country was almost evenly split, with 53% in favor of the liberal status quo. Even so, parliament outlawed abortion in 1993 with three exceptions: danger to the health or life of the mother, rape or incest, fetal abnormalities. After the ban, abortion swiftly moved underground. Doctors who had previously offered free termination in public hospitals charged handsomely for terminations in private clinics. They offered gynecological services through classified ads with only a phone number and code words like anesthesia and safe. Everyone just made do, Sroda said. It was a bigger problem for women from smaller towns and villages who did not have sufficient means for an abortion in a private clinic. Or as Kapura put it, the ban has done a lot of things. What it hasn't done is stop abortions. In 1996, a left-leaning parliament passed a law restoring abortion rights, only to have it struck down by the Constitutional Court a few months later, citing Article 38 of the Polish Constitution, which protects the life of every human being. The court ruled that this included unborn life. It was a harbinger of a broader shift. Over the next two decades, public schools were obliged to teach children about responsible parenthood and life in the prenatal phase. Abortion became a taboo. An emboldened anti-abortion movement started lobbying and taking away the most used exception to the ban, fetal abnormalities, which had been used for almost all of the 1,000 legal abortions a year in Poland. After the Nationalist Law and Justice Party won power in 2015, it embraced a near-absolute ban as part of its traditionalist agenda. A wave of mass protest ensued. Legislation promoting the ban twice failed to pass in Parliament, but it took effect anyway last year after Poland's highest court intervened again. Aborting a fetus with abnormalities, said the court's president, Julia Sielewska, constituted eugenic practices and a directly forbidden form of discrimination. In nearly three decades, there have been only a handful of abortion-related trials, and no doctors, women, or activists have so far been convicted, Kekpura said. But the political climate has become progressively more intimidating, she and other activists say. Underground, abortions have largely stopped, forcing women to either import pills or travel to clinics just over the borders with the Czech Republic, Germany, and Slovakia. Few now openly call for a full return to the liberal abortion rights of communist times. The anti-abortion camp holds regular family marches, and billboard campaigns with outsized fetuses are a common sight across the country. Though two exceptions to the Polish abortion ban remain, in practice, neither is used much. Rape victims require a certificate from a prosecutor, which takes time to obtain. And as Sabor's case illustrates, serious risk to the mother's health now competes with that to the fetus. Sabor, a 30-year-old hairdresser from the small town of Pszczyna in southern Poland, had been thrilled to be pregnant. She wanted a sibling for her 9-year-old daughter, Maja. It was a shock when in her 14th week she learned that doctors suspected her fetus had Edwards syndrome, a serious chromosomal abnormality, and diagnosed other malformations. Instead of a nose, there was only cartilage. The feet were deformed. One heart chamber was dysfunctional. Sabor would have had an abortion if it had still been available in Poland, said her sister-in-law and close friend Barbara Skrobol. She even asked her local doctor about it last summer, but was told it was not an option. At that point, she looked into having an abortion abroad, but then her water broke, Skrobol recalled in an interview. When Sabor was admitted to a hospital September 21st, her mother and husband were not allowed to be with her because of COVID restrictions. I have to give birth to a dead baby, she texted her mother. Thanks to PIS, I am lying down and waiting, she wrote, referring to the governing party by its Polish acronym. By the time the baby's heartbeat stopped and the doctors took Sabor into the operating room the next morning, her limbs had already gone blue. She died at 7:30 a.m. When Sabor's family went public with her case in November, it prompted nationwide protests. It was the first time that a woman was thought to have died because of the abortion ban, Kekpora said. The hospital later issued a statement defending the doctor's actions, saying that they had done everything in their power to save her life and had acted in accordance with Polish law. In a light-filled 6-4 clinic in a leafy corner of central Berlin, Dr. Sabine Mueller, who has been a gynecologist for more than 25 years, now reserves half of her abortion slots for Polish women. The demand has gone up, Mueller said, sitting in her consulting room one recent morning, and the stories have gotten worse. We have a lot of Polish women with cancer who are told, no, we can't give you cancer treatments because you're pregnant and it could hurt the baby, Mueller said. Recently, a 39-year-old woman with metastasizing bronchial cancer came for an abortion after her Polish doctor had delayed her chemotherapy for 6 weeks. Cancer spreads extremely fast during pregnancy, Mueller said. A 6-week delay is almost a death sentence. About 80 Polish women a year used to visit Heemstede, an abortion clinic near Amsterdam that specializes in late-term abortions, which are allowed in the Netherlands until the 24th week. Last year, of 3,000 abortions performed there, 400 were provided to Polish women. We used to be a clinic for unwanted pregnancies, said Fimke von Straten, the clinic's manager. The Polish women that come here now are a very different group. Many wanted to have a child and were heartbroken to discover, well into their second trimesters, that their fetuses had serious defects. To comfort Polish patients, the clinic staff is learning Polish, and the clinic started cooperating with the local cemetery, which runs a memorial garden where, once a month, ashes of fetuses are scattered. When Heemstede opened in 1971, the Dutch justice minister tried to shut it down, and women's groups routinely clashed with riot police officers just outside its gates. Now anti-abortion protesters are showing up again. It's like going 50 years back in time, she said. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Thank you. Here's one of the obituaries. The pundit who argued cordially for liberalism, Mark Shields, 1937 to 2022. Mark Shields was a staunch liberal known for sparring with conservatives, but without ever getting ruffled. Wit and geniality were the calling cards of the longtime syndicated columnist and television pundit, who appeared from 1987 until 2020 as a commentator on PBS NewsHour throughout six presidential administrations. He was also a moderator and panelist on CNN's weekly show, Capital Gang, from 1988 to 2005. On both shows, Shields was pitted against formidable conservative foils, including William Safire, David Brooks, and David Gergen. But it was never a fight. His outspoken liberalism was always delivered with a lack of pretense and a good dose of humor, and he was willing to take occasional aim at his own side. George Washington couldn't tell a lie, while Richard Nixon could never tell the truth, Shields said during Bill Clinton's presidency. Clinton is the president who cannot tell the difference. Shields was born into a family of devoted Democrats in Weymouth, Massachusetts, said the New York Times. His father was a paper salesman involved in local politics, his mother a former school teacher. He studied philosophy at Notre Dame, then spent 2 years in the Marines before starting his political career as a legislative assistant to a Wisconsin senator. He then struck out on his own as a political consultant and worked on Robert Kennedy's presidential run in 1968. For more than a decade, Shields managed campaigns for a host of well-known Democrats, including Morris Udall and Edmund Muskie, said the New York Post. He left politics for commentary in 1979, becoming an editorial writer and then a columnist for the Washington Post. A Washington fixture, he was given prime tables at power lunches, where he always ordered tab. As a commentator, Shields blended his understanding of politics with his easy likability and gift for storytelling, said the Washington Post. After retiring from PBS NewsHour in 2020, Shields taught at Georgetown University and the University of Pennsylvania and was in demand as a speaker and MC. While he continued seeking to hold the government to account, he retained a liberal's belief in its power to better people's lives. Politicians can be petty, venal, and self-centered, he wrote, but I believe politics, at its best, can help to make ours a world where the powerful are truly more just and the poor are more secure. We'll flip over to the Talking Points page. An article referring back to that cover drawing. Pence, the hero of January 6. American democracy withstood Donald Trump's attempted coup in no small part because of the heroism of former Vice President Mike Pence, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. The January 6 House panel's televised hearings last week showed in harrowing detail how mobs chanting "Hang Mike Pence" came within 40 feet of the Vice President, while Pence stood firm against the illegal strategy to overturn Joe Biden's victory. Even as rioters were storming the Capitol, Trump tweeted an attack on Pence, and a Proud Boys informant testified that the far-right group would have killed Pence if given the chance. January 6 was a true trial of Pence's evangelical Christian faith, said David French in the Dispatch. Many fellow evangelicals sold out their principles to Trump in return for power. Yet Pence risked his future in politics and even his life because of his commitment to justice and principle. Our nation should be grateful. Pence is hardly a hero, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. For 4 years, he gave the Christian credibility to the Trump's administration's manifest sins. And on January 6, he simply chose not to break the law. To borrow a phrase from George W. Bush, it is the soft bigotry of low expectations to act as if Pence did anything exceptional by not participating in a coup. In fact, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian, Pence weighed whether to go along with the cockamamie scheme to refuse to certify the election results and sought former Vice President Dan Quayle's advice before declining. American democracy shouldn't be dependent on something as flimsy as Mike Pence's honor. The January 6th panel has asked Pence to testify, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But he's declined and criticized the panel for trying to distract voters from the Democrats' failed agenda. Why? Pence is planning a 2024 presidential run himself and knows he has no chance in the Trumpified GOP if he testifies truthfully about his deranged former boss. That's why he now speaks proudly of the Trump-Pence agenda. Sorry, but Pence can't pretend to be Trump's loyal sidekick while also being praised as the public servant who bravely defied a president's illegal order. As long as Republicans embrace the big lie, Pence's proudest moment will be seen in the GOP as an act of betrayal. Biden, too old to run in 2024? Many Democratic insiders are conceding privately what's long been obvious. President Biden should not run for re-election in 2024, said Mark Leibovich in The Atlantic. He's hardly the doddering, dementia-ridden caricature depicted in right-wing media, but Biden does look and sound older and more tentative than he did 2 years ago. Spinal arthritis causes him to walk with a stiff gait, and he frequently mangles sentences and loses his train of thought, while nearby aides look visibly nervous. He will be 80 in November and 86 at the end of a hypothetical second term. He says he plans to run for re-election, but that's just too old. Saddled with approval ratings of about 40% amid high inflation and soaring gas prices, Biden is coming to represent the tired and hobbled state of his agenda and the Democratic Party. Liberals covered their eyes as long as they could, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. At the first Democratic debate in 2019, Biden had clearly lost a verbal and maybe mental step, but he prevailed because he offered their safest, best chance to beat former President Trump. But with the electorate unhappy, Democrats face a wipeout in the midterm elections. Unfortunately for Democrats, as anyone with older parents knows, taking away their car keys can be a difficult conversation. Even if Biden steps aside, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post, Democrats have the weakest possible bench. Vice President Harris' approval ratings are as dismal as Biden's, and other names being floated, Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg, are failed 2020 retreads. Plan B candidates in state houses don't offer a lot of hope, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic. Governors J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, Jared Polis of Colorado, and Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan all have minimal national name recognition. It's hard to imagine a scenario in which swapping out Biden for an unknown governor doesn't get treated as a panicky decision. Harris is damaged politically, said Jeff Greenfield in Politico. But if Democrats reject the first female and non-white vice president in an open primary, it could alienate enough black and women voters to doom the nominee. None of this, of course, is set in stone. Biden's approval may get a boost if the national mood brightens, or if the alternative is a second Trump term. But Democrats have ample reason to be losing sleep. And we'll wind down with some shorter notes. About one in five pregnancies in the U.S. ended in abortion in 2020, according to a report by the Guttmacher Institute. There were more than 930,000 abortions that year, up from about 862,000 in 2017. With about a third of the 2022 primaries completed, Republican voters have chosen at least 108 candidates for Congress or statewide offices who say the 2020 election was rigged. Another 40 have campaigned on a platform of tightening voting rules or more stringently enforcing existing rules. Border officials have made 1.44 million arrests of migrants this fiscal year, according to the Department of Homeland Security data. Monthly arrests reached another record high in May with 222,656 apprehended. About a quarter had tried to cross the border before. A record low 81% of Americans say they believe in God, according to a new Gallup poll. More than 90% said they believed from 1944 through 2011. Fewer than 70% of liberals and young adults say they believe in a single deity, while self-identified conservatives maintain a high level of belief, 94%. On the poll watch, 58% of Americans think former President Donald Trump should be charged with a crime for his role in the January 6th Capitol riot, an increase of 6% since the House hearings on the insurrection began. 91% of Democrats, 19% of Republicans, and 62% of independents now think Trump should be charged with a crime. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Lily Tomlin, quoted in Parade, who says, "The trouble with the rat race is that even if you win, you're still a rat." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.